Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, obesity is a risk factor for COVID-19 patients getting sicker and dying. But up front, the United Kingdom began administering vaccinations against COVID-19 earlier this week. Canada has approved a vaccine. Some other nations have as well. A vaccine could be coming very soon in the United States. Once it is approved, distributing one or more vaccines will be a major logistical challenge, especially considering vaccines were developed in record time. A local man, Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Yinkst, is the chief of plans for Operation Warp Speed, the federal program to develop and distribute the vaccine. Lieutenant Colonel Yinkst, who is a native of New Oxford in Adams County, is with us today. Lieutenant Colonel Yinkst, welcome to the program.
Welcome. How are you today, Scott?
Doing very well, thank you. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Lieutenant Colonel, I have to ask you right up front, what are the responsibilities of the chief of plans for Operation Warp Speed?
Well, I'm in charge of sort of putting it all together on a platform so we all discuss, and by we all, I mean the Center of Disease Control and the experts, the scientists, the planners, and putting all phases of the operation into a simple format that we can understand.
When you say a simple format, I think for many of us, it probably sounds like an understatement. How do you do something that has been done in record time and will be distributed quickly, considering the logistical issues involved? How do you put that into simple form?
So what we do is we leverage all the experts that are out there. We look at the experts of industry, the shipping industry experts, our private partner relations we have leveraged with our distribution partners, the FedExes and the UPSs. We also leverage the McKesson shipping group. And what we do is we make sure that everybody knows their part. And that's really the key of what we've done throughout the course of multiple weeks of preparation through our tabletop exercises.
You've been in the military for a long time. You were U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel. You served in Afghanistan and Iraq. How is this similar to strategizing or making plans for a military operation?
It goes back to everyone has to know their part. Years ago, I was a planner co-authoring the war plan for the Army in the peninsula of Korea. And we pulled together all the experts there, from the military policemen to the infantrymen, and we made sure everybody knew their part and how they interacted with each other. And I think that's the key. We all know our individual day role, but with this Operation Warp Speed, there's a lot of uniqueness to it. And you hit on it. It is novel. It's new. It's rapid. It's rapid execution. I'll tell you this: we already have kits moving to final destinations for needles and things like that. We've already started to move that. Now, we have not moved any vaccine. There's still triggers that need to be pulled for that, but we've already started the process.
You see, again, you just brought up something that probably many people don't think about, because they think of the distribution of the vaccine, and we're picturing those vials coming out and being delivered. But there's so much more that goes into it than just the vials themselves, the needles, the people who will be administering the vaccine, knowing what they're doing. Talk about everything that is, okay, maybe not everything, but the things that are involved other than just delivering the vials of the vaccine.
So, Scott, great point. Look, weeks ago, in early November, we laid out the process and the mechanics for moving what we call kits. And those kits include, if we've got to deliver 300 million doses, and it's a two-dose regimen, at 600 million needles, 600 million sets of gloves and things that go into these kits. Now, we've got not only planners determining what those numbers should be, but we've got people in the operations side that need to then go and secure that quantity of, and we call them ancillary kits, and the components of those kits. It is a full process. And not only kits, Scott, I'd mention one other thing is at the administration sites, individuals are being trained on new processes to administer these vaccinations. And it is a mixture of a diluent on some cases, and how to mix that and store that and hold that is very exhaustive. So, you know, earlier I mentioned simple. Collectively, it is not simple. But what we try to do in the plans is make it individually understandable and executable as far as the plan.
And I'm going to touch on many of those things, Lieutenant Colonel, but I know the big question that you've been asked and many people are wondering about is when. When do we think we will see a vaccine being delivered across the U.S.?
We've already seen it in the national news that the U.K. and Canada have approved their first vaccination for Pfizer. Today, the VRBPAC meets, which is the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee. That committee, the VRBPAC, released information on Pfizer 2 days ago. Today, they meet, and at 3 o'clock this afternoon, they put up for vote their recommendation to the FDA. And their recommendation would be, if they choose to do so, would be to approve the use of a vaccination. That would be a recommendation, that recommendation going to the FDA. Should the FDA authorize an emergency use authorization, that could happen anytime after today's vote and recommendation from the VRBPAC. For us, what that means is we go into the plan and we look and see what our, we call it day zero key actions would be. And then we put some things into play, and we really are waiting for the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices to recommend how to administer that vaccination to the CDC, and then CDC would approve. So those things are likely to occur. They could occur as soon as in the next 24 to 48 hours. But we stand waiting for those advisory committees to make their recommendations.
So when those recommendations occur and the approval is given, how quickly can you move?
Well, our plan has vaccine moving within the first 24 hours. I will tell you this though, as soon as we are alerted from the FDA, within an hour, our senior leadership will meet and authorize the distribution. And by senior leadership, that's General Perna. We have a meeting scheduled 1 hour after, should it occur, to initiate distribution.
And General Perna, he is your direct supervisor, correct?
My direct supervisor is Mr. Maddox, and then we go right to General Perna on all issues. Mr. Maddox is the senior advisor to General Perna.
We have a question from a listener. Wants to know, how long ago did you begin estimating the number of shots and kits? Who is manufacturing those, and aren't other countries trying to obtain those as well?
I am aware of some issues in getting some of the needles, but we've been able to attain enough needles to vaccinate for the vaccines that we have being produced. I'm not in particularly aware of any sort of unique struggle to acquire them, other than that I know we have enough needles and syringes to administer the vaccines we have in storage.
But I think that one of the things that the listener was interested in is, how did you come up with that number of 300 million and two, it has to be administered twice? Is it just based on a 300 million population in the United States?
Loosely, that in when we first were stood up, that was our mission. Our mission we were given for Operation Warp Speed was deliver 300 million vaccines to the American people. And what we found out later that the vaccines were a two regimen dose. So each individual would need, in theory, two doses for an effective vaccination. Well, that means that doubled all our numbers. So we went from 300 million, quite frankly, to 600 million. And we actually have secured additional, a little beyond the 600 million, or just to make sure we have enough for any overage or lossage, or make sure folks have, the administrators have enough on hand.
You know, we've been talking a lot about delivering the vaccine and the kits, but who or what will these kits and the vaccines be delivered to?
So what we've done, our plan has is along the CDC recommend the CDC breakout of jurisdictions, and the jurisdictions include the 50 states, U.S. territories, a few major cities to include Philadelphia and D.C., and also some federal entities such as the Department of Defense. So we have a data system called Tiberius, which is a collective tool that collects all the planning data and has pictorials of each jurisdiction and also the points in which those jurisdictions want to administer the initial phases and the subsequent phases of vaccines. So for Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania last Monday met with General Perna on what we call a jurisdiction deep dive. And as part of the plans chief, our team facilitated that discussion to make sure that we know exactly where the jurisdiction, in this case, Pennsylvania, wants to put their initial doses of Pfizer. And what happens then is on day zero, when an EUA be authorized, we know exactly where to ship to put those shipping labels on the boxes that have the vaccines, and we can send them within 24 hours.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about, and maybe this is just layman looking at the logistical challenge of this, but for example, getting the correct number or an adequate number of doses to an urban area, which would seem to be easier, if you will, versus rural areas of Pennsylvania and across the country. Are there challenges in getting these doses and knowing the number of doses that have to go to, say, rural areas?
Absolutely. Each jurisdiction and each jurisdiction, each state has a plan. But what we've been able to do is look at methods to get to those rural populations by what we call a hub and spoke. And that hub would receive the vaccines in a shipping container and then be able to spoke out to the rural areas and deliver vaccines. We find it that each jurisdiction has sort of a unique twist on it. But those plans are in place, by and large, and are ready and executable.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Joining us on this portion of the program is Army Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Yingst. He's Chief of Plans for Operation Warp Speed, distributing the coronavirus vaccine once it is approved. Lieutenant Colonel Yingst is a native of New Oxford in Adams County. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Lieutenant Colonel Yingst, we've heard a lot about some of the storage requirements for at least the Pfizer vaccine. You know, that the temperatures have to be, I mean, there's freezers that, the whole new industry has popped up, the manufacturer of these freezers. Freezers have been distributed across the country and around the world to be able to store the Pfizer vaccine. What kind of challenge is that storage and storage when the vaccine is being moved across the country? How much of a challenge is that?
You know, that's been one of our significant challenges. And with, you know, when you have one of the first vaccines that's likely to come out in the next a few days, perhaps. We've got to make sure that that system and that supply chain is in place on day one, and we can't afford foreseeable failures. Our struggle has been through the tabletop exercises and the rehearsals we've had along the way is to determine what is possible, and then after what is possible, how do we make it happen? So we've got mechanisms in place to monitor the temperatures of vaccines from the manufacturer all the way to the sites of administration. And so now that you have the ability to monitor, it is how do you ensure that cold chain is in place throughout? And we have a series of refrigeration systems, ultra low temperature freezers, and also dry ice while in transit to ensure that the vaccines are safe and remain effective when they get to that points of administration.
Have those freezers been distributed across the country yet?
Well, I'll tell you this. We as a federal government, as a federal entity, as a government, we rely on the jurisdictions and the states to put in place their mechanisms to ensure cold storage once it enters their state officially. As far as refrigeration and manufacturing has quite a robust system to maintain ultra low temperatures. So really our focus has been on the distribution and then the transport from the manufacturer to the state's plan.
One of the things I'm thinking about, and I don't know whether you can identify this or not, but, it's almost a cliche that an effort is only as strong as its weakest link. Now, I'm not going to ask you to identify the weakest link, but what concerns you? What, maybe I guess I can ask, the biggest challenge in all this?
My biggest concern is wastage. And by wastage, there's an acceptable level, and let me rephrase that. There's no acceptable level. The goal is zero wastage. And my concern is that we have wastage, because wastage means that's doses that cannot be delivered to the American public. So everything we do, everything my team does, tries to minimize that waste to zero. The goal is zero, and that's the acceptable level of wastage. We've got to get over this as a nation, as a community, and that's my biggest concern, and that's what I have my team focusing on daily.
I understand that part of your responsibility as well is to make sure that those who are administering the vaccine know what they're doing, that they've been trained, they know how to administer this vaccine. How do you go about that?
The CDC has a great team, and their team is headed by Dr. Amanda Cohn. And Dr. Cohn has a robust education platform that's available on cdc.gov. And also the manufacturers, Pfizer and all the manufacturers we're working with, have unique methods of administering the vaccine that they have released information on their websites. And upon EUA, if the FDA chooses to issue an emergency use authorization, they will distribute additional educational materials based off of the recommendations of the Vaccines and Related Biologicals Product Advisory Committee, and also the Advisory Committee on the Immunization Practices that will advise the CDC. So there's a lot of educational materials that are out there on the CDC website.
Let's take a phone call from Virginia in Hummelstown, Virginia. You're on the air.
For taking the call.
Yes.
I'm glad you said the education piece, because that to me is the biggest thing. When people take the vaccine, if they do not understand that there may be a low-grade fever, there may be body aches and pains, that they can have a very sore arm for about 24 hours, people are not going to come back for that second dose. And we need that second dose to have an adequate vaccine. So I think it's very important. You can give them all the web sources there, but people will not read them. They'll just say, oh, I got the flu from the vaccine or something like that. So I think it's extremely important for people to understand, because I know somebody who participated in the early trials, and she said, look at it as your system kicking the vaccine kicking your immune system into overdrive. And that's what people need to know. It is expected, because that's a good response to the vaccine.
Virginia, thank you very much for your call. Lieutenant Colonel Yingst, I don't know how involved you are and your team is involved in education, but the point that Virginia makes is a real good one, that this is not just something that people can just go get a shot and expect to feel 100% perfect right off the bat and think that maybe I don't need to go get a second shot. There is a lot to this, and as she mentioned, education is a big part of it.
He's got, you know, Virginia's right. There is a big part of education, and what she's touched upon and discussed is exactly one of our concerns. If this is a safe and effective vaccine, there, like many other vaccines, my understanding is that there may be some of that reaction to it. We'd ask that this, for us to get over this as a nation, it is really our responsibility to be informed, find the information, and make that personal decision. For me, I know my family will most likely get this vaccine. I'm confident in the effectiveness and understand what it takes for us to get over this. I know my parents that are in New Oxford, Pennsylvania, are still deciding. And I respect that. And I don't try to persuade them. I only offer that they find the information on the CDC website and make an informed decision.
So your parents haven't even decided when their son is involved in the distribution, really?
Scott, that's right. my parents are like others. It needs to be an individual decision and informed. I would not try to persuade my parents, only to let them know my role is on distribution and inform themselves based off of the information out there. The Verb Pack, as I said before, has put a lot of technical information on their website. The point I shared with them was, and this is very little detail, but on page 58 of the Pfizer pamphlet, there's a graphic that shows the effectiveness of this vaccine, and it's compelling for me. So I shared that with them, and I think they're leaning yes, but I would never speak for them.
Why wouldn't they? And I'm not, okay, not just your parents, but those who would decide not to. I saw a poll today that, well, this was like a compilation of polls. 33% to 47% of people say they won't get vaccinated. Why wouldn't they?
Look, it's new. It has not been, it's not widely available. There's an unknownness to it. I would share this with you. The Pfizer test has been very effective. It is an effective vaccination. And quite frankly, in my opinion, if it's approved, I will take it. So I can't speak beyond that, but I would let you know that it seems to be very effective.
Getting back to distribution, I understand that security is a key part for delivery of this vaccine. And I wouldn't imagine that you'll give specific details, but talk about what kind of security is there in place.
Anytime you have something as historic and something as changing as this could be for our nation to get us back to what would be a normalcy, there's desire to, you know, as a military individual, we're aware of the desires to disrupt that from our adversaries. For our plans, we have leveraged other parts of government, such as the U.S. Marshals, to secure some of our, the majority of our transits of doses, and also security and cyber mechanisms to make sure that our data systems are secure and we know what's available distribution-wise, what's available to distribute those second doses, and all that cadence that is required to deliver vaccines to the American people.
As we mentioned, Great Britain, the United Kingdom, began administering the vaccine earlier this week. Canada has approved. I saw Saudi Arabia has approved. But what have we learned, if anything, and is there cooperation with other nations on this?
On a routine basis, Scott. So my General Perna's counterpart is Dr. Slawali. Dr. Slawali talks to the his UK counterpart on a biweekly basis. We talk about things to include not only the vaccine effectiveness and development, but the distribution of that. So we've been able to leverage some of those findings to make sure that when we ship, and as we discussed earlier, at ultra low temperatures, that we're learning from their practices already.
Is there anything specifically that we've learned?
What we've found out is to make sure we do the hub and spoke correctly, we've got to make sure we remain in alignment at that jurisdiction level with the guidance and advice and recommendations of the manufacturer. And if we stray from that, we risk, again, going back to wasted, we risk wasting doses. And again, that's our biggest point for the distribution plan is to learn what's happening in the United Kingdom to make sure we minimize those wastage of doses to zero.
You know, I am so glad that you brought that up because that is something that I have to admit that in all the excitement and all the anticipation of a vaccine being approved and being distributed and Americans getting vaccinated, that this is almost the first time I've heard anyone talk about being concerned about wasting. And you made such a great point that if one dose is wasted, that's one dose that doesn't go to someone to keep them from getting the COVID or getting sicker from the COVID. So that's such an important point. Lieutenant Colonel, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You know, it's not often that we have someone in an essential position from our, as you are, from our local area. Growing up in New Oxford, what prepared you for this job?
I had good parents, both educators, both had instilled a sense of hard work and ethic and the willingness to start there, be on a team, be on a team of teams with sports and just grown up in a good community that supported education and growth and understanding. So you know, that formed the basis of me joining at a very young age as a young man. Joining military service and really led to me staying in the military.
Army Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Yinks, Chief of Plans for Operation Warp Speed, and a native of New Oxford in Adams County. Lieutenant Colonel Yinks, thank you very much for being with us today and for your service.
Great. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Gretchen Sorensen, author of the book Driving While Black, and it will be a PBS television documentary, but Gretchen Sorensen, who wrote the book, will be on tomorrow's program. COVID-19 has revealed the uneasy truth about obesity. Medical studies have documented the serious health risk of obesity to include coronary heart disease, diabetes, and certain types of cancer. Now it seems the COVID-19 pandemic is highlighting another pressing health concern. Obesity not only increases complications from a coronavirus infection, but it may also increase the risk of infection in the first place. Joining us is Dr. Catherine Varney. She's a family medicine and obesity specialist with the University of Virginia. Dr. Varney, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I'll start with a basic question, Dr. Varney. Why is obesity a major risk in a person who has contracted COVID-19?
We're still learning because initially we thought that it would only make you sicker, but not increase your chance of being infected in the first place. But now we know that early research is showing that the infection lasts longer in patients with obesity. And so on average, about 5 days longer. And so there's a lot more damage that can be done in those 5 days to the tissue.
Okay. And without getting too far into the weeds, explain why. What in an obese person would contribute to someone being more at risk for contracting COVID-19?
So there's a lot of things, including structure and function. So take structure, for example. So it creates a mechanical compression in patients with obesity, and so it limits their ability to really fully take in and completely release a full breath of air. So it actually takes more work in a patient with obesity just to breathe. So this can cause restrictive lung disease, and in the more serious case, hyperventilation, which can cause the oxygen levels to be lower in their blood. There's also function. The adipose tissue, we previously thought that adipose tissue was just this inert tissue that stored fat. But now we're starting to realize that it's not that. It almost acts as its own endocrine organ, and it's releasing all these chemicals and proteins and these molecules that basically keep people in a constant state of low-grade inflammation.
So, but what you just described there sounds like something that it wouldn't just be a risk for COVID-19, but a lot of other medical conditions or diseases as well.
Yeah, and we see that. We've known that, you know, obesity is related to 236 other diseases, and 13 of those are actually cancer: breast, colon, esophagus, gallbladder, kidney, stomach, uterus. So people that have obesity have a higher risk of getting those types of cancers. But it's interesting, we're finding out so much, and anything I tell you today could be completely proven wrong in a month. We're learning in real time about COVID-19. But one of the things that we think is that this constant state of low-grade inflammation that patients with obesity have, it's kind of like a controlled wildfire. You know, it's there, it's dangerous, but it's not burning the entire forest. So then you get another infection like COVID-19 that comes along, and it creates another wildfire. So put these two things together, and it creates a situation where there's a lot of collateral damage to the tissue. We want the body, people may have heard of this cytokine storm that comes with COVID-19, but, you know, we want cytokines to be released. They're necessary for, you know, the immune process in order to fight disease and infections. But typically it's kept in, you know, there's checks and balances. And when you have this constant low-grade inflammation, it doesn't operate properly. And this is our hypothesis, but of course, you know, we're going to need a lot more studies to prove this.
You know, we had a question from Mike, and Mike kind of anticipated my next question is, can we get a base definition of obesity? What is considered obese?
So obesity is when you have excess adipose tissue that puts your BMI, or your body mass index, at a BMI of greater than 30. And so previously we said, you might have heard these terms called obesity or severe obesity or morbid obesity, but we're really trying to go away from these terms. And we, in obesity medicine, we now use classes. So from a BMI from 30 to 34 is what we call class 1 obesity. Class 2 obesity is from 35 to 39, and then 40 or greater is the most severe type, which is class 3 obesity.
Why are you trying to go away from those classifications? There's other names that you use.
It creates a stigma. Morbidly obese. I remember the first time I saw that on a chart, and I just thought it sounds terrible, morbidly obese, right? There's a big stigma in obesity. We see that even this in healthcare providers, they've done research that show that up to 50% of healthcare providers think that patients that have obesity, it's due to a lack of willpower, or they're eating too much, or, exercising too little. But obesity is a complex, multi-organ, multi-hormonal neurochemical disease and to reduce it to just telling somebody that to have more willpower or push away the plate or eat less, exercise more is not only incorrect, it's morally wrong. We have plenty of studies that show embarrassing someone is counterproductive to weight loss. And in some, it actually makes it worse because it can increase their stress and lead to overeating in an attempt to feel better. Our most primitive, powerful neurochemicals are released when we eat flavorful food. Sugar will light up your brain on imaging studies just as much as some of the most addictive recreational drugs.
So, that stigma is one of the reasons, and you tell me if this is an accurate statement, that stigma for those who are obese or have obesity is one of the reasons that it is that so many people continue to suffer from obesity, and that even physicians are not treating it. Is that correct?
Correct. So let's look at primary care, right? So the hallmark of primary care or family medicine is prevention of disease, right, including obesity. And not talking about obesity is more shameful than just addressing it earlier with compassion. Because, why would I go to a cardiologist but not want him to discuss my cholesterol level? But it happens. And there was a 2015 study in the British Medical Journal that showed that 59% of patients with that class 3 obesity, that most severe obesity, had no record of any weight management advice in their primary care records over a 7-year period. And this is where we need to focus a lot of our efforts on reducing stigma. And we see 85% of patients with diabetes, they have excess weight or obesity. And 88% of these patients take medications for them. So why are we not prescribing medications for obesity? Only less than 2% of patients that are eligible for anti-obesity medications actually receive them.
Why?
That's a good question. I think that it definitely, I think that we fear what we don't know. And studies have shown that we do not, current and future physicians in training, we are not getting really good education about obesity, which is really odd, right? When you think about that 70% of our population has either overweight or obesity, 70%. Physicians are bound to see this in their training, but we get about an average of 10 hours of dedicated time toward obesity medicine in our entire 4 years of medical school.
If you're just tuning in, our guest is Dr. Catherine Varney. She's a family medicine and obesity specialist at the University of Virginia. We're talking about COVID's role, or I should say obesity's role in COVID-19. It's much worse than what we initially thought. But we're talking about obesity overall. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at @SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Faith in Lancaster. Faith, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is this. And this is definitely related to obesity. The doctor is saying it increases inflammation, but so many diseases seem to go along and are contributed to by inflammation, especially as we age. Why not do routine inflammation tests in an annual physical, especially as we age, such as, and the doctor would know better, but high sensitivity, C-reactive protein, and homocysteine levels. And then one more comment. I walk into my local grocery, and right next to the pharmacy are all the goodies for the day from the bakery.
I know. You're right now that I think about that. Hey, Faith, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Vardy, we'll talk about the goodies right next to the pharmacy a little bit later, but her point about inflammation.
Right. So that's a great question. So when we do screening tests in primary care, like say at your annual physical, what we're doing is we're doing tests that have a lot of good data behind them. And unfortunately, because just as she said, many diseases create this chronic low-grade inflammation. If we were to run those tests, they're what we call very nonspecific. They may be elevated, but we may not know why. It may be because somebody had exercised really vigorously the day before, or they had been sick recently, or that they have obesity. So they're non-specific tests, and so the value of those tests, the financial cost and burden to the healthcare system would outweigh the benefits that those tests would give us.
If they were more specific, is there a possibility that wouldn't be true?
Oh, for sure, right? So that's one of the things that, you know, I think that in order to reduce stigma with obesity is actually to increase our research that solidifies, you know, what are the things that we can identify, you know, that are the most effective treatment and screening for reversal and prevention of obesity. Because, and we're learning that, and it's coming, because, you know, right now, you know, things that we've learned in the last 10 years, it's amazing. You know, 40 to 70% of obesity is thought to be related to genetics. So, you know, does lifestyle factors contribute? Absolutely. There will never be successful weight loss without diet and exercises, but people need to recognize that this is only a small percentage of the comprehensive plan that we need to create for patients to succeed.
But
genetics,
you said,
nutrition, hormones, certain medications will cause you to gain weight, environmental, stress, sleep deficit. All of these things have been shown to create obesity.
But you said earlier that what we hear most often from our doctors is eat less, exercise more. Now, you just listed a number of things that you can do to maintain a healthy weight. Why is just eating less and exercising more just too simplistic of advice?
It's old advice that just won't die. You know, I can't remember the study, but, you know, I remember a professor in medical school telling me that, you know, once new information came out, it took the average physician about 10 years to, you know, fully recognize and adopt this new information, because information is constantly changing, right? So I think one of the things that we need to do is we need to first adopt patient-first language. So patient first language is basically saying patients with obesity. I see constantly, you know, when I read articles that the obese patient, you know, and, you know, when you, patients are more than a disease, they're people. And so if you're labeling them just as a disease, it's reducing them as a person. We need universal adoption of patient first language. So, you know, you'll always hear obese patient, but how often do you hear somebody say the gynorrhea patient? No, it's a patient with gynorrhea, right? So patients with obesity. I have fingernails. I have fingernails, but I'm not a fingernail.
Good analogy that probably will get a lot of people's attention. Patty has a question. She says, all of the women I have known who have contracted breast cancer have been underweight. Do we also look at the risk factor of being underweight? I also think we have many people who struggle with eating disorders that can make them very unhealthy. If we could talk about this health picture holistically, it would seem that more people would be willing to listen if we consider all health factors. She says, for example, I think smoking has been less demonized regarding COVID than obesity. So what do you think, doctor?
I think she's completely right. She's talking about a comprehensive plan for obesity, and that's what people need. You know, you want I've heard tons of things, you know, dozens of inflammatory and hurtful things that people say regarding obesity. You know, I recently saw on social media somebody that would be considered, you know, kind of an influencer within nutrition and exercise posted a video of them jumping up and over this 3-foot box and stated the statement was something of, you know, obesity wouldn't be an issue if people worked out like me like this. And, you know, I think we need to realize that we need to meet people where they are. I'm not going to put you on an Atkins diet. I'm not going to put you on a Mediterranean diet. I'm not going to put you on a low-carb or a low-fat diet. I'm going to put you on the Jane Smith diet. And I think that patients, when they know that this is something that has been recommended for me, that they're going to buy into it more. As physicians and healthcare providers, we need to empathize and recognize that each patient has a story that's unique as their own DNA. So we need to create programs that tackle nutrition, you know, lifestyle, what medications can help with this. It's not just a lack of willpower. I've yet to meet a person that has excess weight or obesity say that they've never engaged in a diet or exercise program or that they've not been successful in anything. You know, they've lost weight before. This isn't due to a lack of trying. We have long known that diet and exercise will only result in about 5 to 10% of weight loss. Exercise alone only contributes about 2 to 5% of weight loss. It's very important for keeping your weight, you know, once you lose the weight, keeping your weight maintained. But actually, for losing weight, it only contributes 2 to 5%. So adding medication, we can increase our patient success by up to 20%. And then if we have them with weight loss surgery, we can increase their success of 30 to 40% of excess weight loss.
You know, something I'm thinking of as we're talking about this, though, the motivation for people maintaining a good weight is that often it's a vanity thing rather than being motivated by health. How do you get that message across to people that they would be healthier, live longer even, if they did not suffer from obesity?
Yeah, you know, I've been warning my patients for years that, you know, obesity could take, you know, years off their life. And, you know, it's been shown that obesity can take up to 8 years off your life. But now, you know, now more than ever, this warning has become verifiable with seeing what acutely COVID does to patients with obesity. So I think that it's just about education. We need, you know, we need to educate current and future physicians, and not just physicians, all healthcare providers, and start really tackling the underlying issue of the, you know, these 236 diseases. Let's stop putting a Band-Aid on things with medications and, you know, medications alone. Let's get to the root of diabetes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol. Let's take care of obesity and really address it.
Dr. Catherine Varney is a family medicine physician and obesity specialist with the University of Virginia. Dr. Varney, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.